any multicellular organism can be thought of as eusocial among its own cells.
It went and tried to bury itself because it was like, well, I guess I'm dead.
But then when you say, okay, and the way we're going to do that is to sterilize everyone who's not that way, then it's like, whoa!
All the best dystopias come out of Britain thinking they're better than everybody else. Philosophers.
Philosophers.
You want to know something, David?
Sure.
Society.
Society. We live in one.
We live in a society.
What philosophers.
Philosophers. What is a society?
That's a good question.
What is society? So.
Society.
Society. I hate this. So, Oxford Languages defines society as the aggregate of people living together in more or less ordered community, in a more or less ordered community, or an organization or club formed for a particular purpose or activity, i.e. the American Society for the Prevention of the Cruelty to Animals, or the ASPCA, which, by the way, terrible acronym.
So, a different definition from the American Heritage Dictionary. A group of people broadly distinguished from other groups by mutual interests, participation in characteristic relationships, shared institutions, and a common culture.
Yep. So, what did those two definitions have in common? They're about people.
Yes.
Well, what about other things that aren't people? Do they have societies?
By this definition, no.
Yeah, but zoologists would disagree. And, I think I would like to maybe discuss the societies of other animals, or plants, for that matter. What does a plant society look like?
Looking at you, fungus. Actually, fungus is not plant.
No, technically not.
Their own category. They're, okay, fungi are aliens. Change my mind.
Okay, that's next week's episode. We've had evidence of aliens this whole time. It's called fungi.
Aren't they weird?
They are weird. We may get into fungal societies soon. So, there's a particular type of non-human society that a lot of people espouse as like something to admire. So, first of all, zoologists are all commies. Just throwing that out there. No, I'm just kidding. They're not. But I think maybe a little bit, because I don't know how you would describe like human society. Okay, so this is, it's sociality, I think, is the word I'm looking for, which is very related to society. So sociality is the degree to which individuals in an animal population tend to associate in social groups, or gregariousness, and form cooperative societies. I love that word. Very gregarian of you.
Gregariosity.
So there's actually a hierarchy of these socialities. And the one that we're going to go through some of these, but I want to start with the one that made me want to do this episode and make me angry. Eusociality.
Yes.
So,
first of all, do you know what the prefix "eu" means?
Good.
Yes.
The good society.
Right. Just defined as the good, maybe even the best society, the perfect society.
I.e. zoologists or commies. But.
Yes.
What is eusociality plainly? I'll read the definition out of Wikipedia in a minute, but like, roughly speaking, what is it?
Every member of the society cooperates directly, usually under the control of some leader.
Something to that effect. I'm going to go and read the definition.
Basically, so, multiple individuals act kind of as one organism, almost.
Sort of, kind yes. Of. Yes, kind of. There's a very, I think, specific thing that makes eusociality work. And it has to do with more their the genetics of the organism. So, for example, there are twins in humans. Mm-hmm. They share genetics, right? Well, at least when they're born. They can be damaged differently over time based on their experience. But when the moment of conception, they shared the same DNA sequences, right? And they are at the moment of conception in the same, or the moment they split and become two distinct zygotes, they're in practically the same environment. So from there, they're essentially the same, but they're separate organisms, mm-hmm. right? The concept of a superorganism is important because what a superorganism is a group of individual organisms that all share the same genetic makeup. And so, and this is what makes eusociality work, is that the individuals do not matter from a genes perspective, just certain of the individuals who are able to populate. So
I mean, like, essentially, any multicellular organism can be thought of as eusocial among its own cells,
yes.
right? Its cells exist as a, you know, you could say any multicellular organism is a colony of eusocial cells.
Yeah, essentially.
Because they all share the same genetic material and operate mm-hmm. as a unit.
Correct. This
and,
is
and the life of any individual cell does not matter to the whole.
Correct. This is that up a level where
it's made of multicellular organisms.
Correct.
Yeah.
So to read the definition formally, eusociality from the Greek eu, or good, and social, the highest level of organization of sociality is defined by the following characteristics: cooperative brood care, including care of offspring from other individuals, overlapping generations within a colony of adults, and a division of labor into reproductive and non-reproductive groups. The division of labor creates specialized behavioral groups within an animal society, which are sometimes referred to as castes. Eusociality is distinguished from all other social systems because individuals of at least one caste usually lose the ability to perform at least one behavior characteristic of individuals in other castes. Eusocial colonies can be viewed as social, or sorry, superorganisms. So it goes on to say that eusociality exists in certain insects, crustaceans, and mammals, and is mostly observed and studied in the Hymenoptera and the Blattidia, which are, Hymenoptera are ants, bees, and wasps. They're all the same for this purposes, and Blattidia are termites. So that's like the two ones that everyone thinks of. Mm-hmm. So pretty much anything you can think of as a hive that has a queen, these are typically, not always, but that's, start thinking that way and you'll start getting to eusociality. And that's kind of the point. Most of the bees, ants, termites, or wasps don't need to be doing the reproducing. That's fine. They're
right. They have work to do.
Right. They have work to do, and their work can still help their. You can pass
because they
on,
share. Yeah, because their genetic relationship is such that. Yeah, they can forego reproduction, and their work benefits the propagation of their genes.
Right,
which is the driving influence of what characteristics make it through natural selection.
Exactly. So, instead of the drive being to reproduce, the drive is to aid in the reproductive process without actually having to reproduce yourself.
Again, right, so long as there are more copies of your genes as the end result, then your behavior is successful in terms of natural selection.
Right, which is why it exists. So, this leads to very interesting things. I don't think it's any mistake that they label members of the different behavioral groups as castes. I'm pretty sure that word predates our study of eusocial insects and eusocial creatures. Mm-hmm. I know it from, what is it, Hindi? In Indian culture?
Yes.
I don't know which specific subculture within India it comes from.
Hindi is a language.
Hinduism, that's what it is. Hinduism, yes. Sorry. Not from India. What is their caste? Like, what is a caste system, I guess, in that context?
I don't know all the... Well, yeah, okay. I mean, like, yeah, the caste system, basically, like, yeah, certain people have their lot in life, so to speak, and it is forbidden to step out of that societal role, basically.
Yeah.
It's like a generic summation of a caste system.
Yeah. So it's, to sum up, well, thank you for covering while I looked it up.
It's a social hierarchy passed down through families, and it can dictate the professions a person can work in, as well as other aspects of their social lives, including whom they can marry, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes
basically roles. It's a class system, but you're not allowed to cross the barriers.
Yeah,
there's nothing you can do to break out of your class.
Right. So, for example, if you were born into a working class family in Detroit of people working in automotive factories,
that is your destiny.
Yeah. And you must do that.
And you will be an outcast if you try to break that mold.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, not too different, I suppose. I imagine if there was a defective ant that got a mind of its own, which, to be fair, I think most humans also maybe have a deep down agreement on this, given how much we seem to hate cancer, which is what happens when one of your cells is like, how about I don't die on command and I just keep reproducing?
Yeah. What if I just do my own thing?
Yeah. Cancer. I don't know. I hate the, there's nothing wrong with identifying this and recognizing it as being an excellent strategy for ensuring the passing on of your genes.
Well, yeah, clearly it's worked.
The sidebar that makes me just so touchy about the subject is how many people use this as an example for how we as humans should be, even though we are fundamentally genetically different and we literally cannot that.
Right. I think people, well, as with many things, people are quick to anthropomorphize everything that we see.
Yep.
And so we look at the colony of ants cooperating together, not thinking about the genetic forces at play which caused them to behave that way, and say, man, wouldn't it be beautiful if we could all cooperate like that? Think of all the things that we could get done.
Right. We could build dirt mounds and...
Yes.
stuff.
And sting things.
And sting things. And live very short, hard lives where we're essentially just...
Drones.
Yeah. Great. But yeah, I don't know. It is interesting. I think it's hard to conceptualize what it would be like to be in a society like that. Like,
well, yeah, imagine if the next time you smelled something, you just changed your mind about what you were doing that day. Because that's how the ant do.
Yeah, you resumed function. You didn't sleep. You just resumed functioning. And, well, I guess it's time to go follow these ants and see what they're doing. Well, actually, worse than that, you probably don't have a memory.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. I think of as a computer programmer guy,
mm-hmm.
I think of these guys as little state machines, right?
This is not too inaccurate, actually, from right. how they actually are.
I mean, arguably, all living things are some form of state machine.
But these are very simple state machines.
They're much simpler. Yeah. Much shorter memory of what they were up to. Yeah, they're just directly responding to whatever stimulus they're getting.
Yeah, I think the best example of this that I think is funny is there was a video, I don't know if you sent it to me, it was a guy who's raising ants, and he collects their pheromones during different states, or he can make them somehow. And he put the pheromone that is associated with death on one ant, and his thought was that the other ants, like of a dead ant, because when an ant dies, it releases certain scents, and that tells the other ants to take it and go put it in the ant graveyard. So he thought this one ant was going to be essentially taken to the graveyard and buried alive. Worse, it went and tried to bury itself because it was like, well, I guess I'm dead. And the state machine is so simple that it has no concept of I'm alive. It's just, well, I'm dead.
I smell death. Yeah.
Yeah. And
so I will do the death thing.
Right. And But imagine it be that way for people, or it's just like, I just feel like I'm dying. So instead of addressing the problems, like, well, time to go
start digging my own grave. Yeah.
Yeah. Like you go out to the cemetery and start digging a hole, and then you climb into it and die, or you bury yourself alive and then you die from that. And it's just fine. Like it's just what you do, you know, and no one cares because that's just how it is. And I think that's just interesting to think about, and it's just very different. But that's the one I hate is you can't look at, it's apples and oranges. You can't look at how the ant do and think, wow, it is impressive how these...
How noble of them to cooperate with each other like that. It's like, no, they literally can't do anything else.
Yeah, they do not have a choice. That's the whole thing.
Yeah, they are just drones. Yeah.
Right. And even though most humans like to operate, though we have
choice. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong. Well, this is, goes back to a way old episode of ours about free will. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with believing you have choices if that makes it easier for you to just make up your mind already and do something, you know?
Right. Yeah. I think at a metaphysical level, there's no free will. But on a practical level, there kind of is.
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, right?
We can. It is fair enough to treat it that way, yes.
Because regardless of how you came to your outcome, we can treat it either way, and it's good enough for our purposes. Was that episode? If you're more interested in that, it's an older episode about free will.
Yeah. There's other levels to that. Like, you know, basically, I think the most profound thing that comes out of that is like implications of criminal justice.
Sure.
But that's a different topic.
Right. And that's another interesting thing. Criminal justice, does that even apply in an ant-like society?
No.
No.
There are no criminals.
Right. Because you can't commit a crime. Because you can't...
You're just responding to the stimulus.
Right.
Basically, this has implications about our own criminals, but... I mean, okay... If there were ant psychologists that had to psychoanalyze, any ant that is not obeying the stimulus the same way is not a criminal. It's just broken. It's mentally ill.
It's defective.
Yeah. Which is kind of how we treat criminals.
It's an interesting meta commentary on humanity. Yeah. We go so far to do. I wonder if ants will take, quote, defective ants and put them in... defective ant pens.
I doubt it.
Yeah, because
I'm sure most ants that don't follow the stimulus just end up wandering off and dying because they're not cooperating.
Maybe. Or it would be very similar to, well, that's an interesting thing to think about. So our body has cells that sometimes stop cooperating, and it's nothing to do with them being like, not cancer necessarily, but like it's just defective in some way. But our immune system will still try to kick it out sometimes. And then what happens when
I would not be surprised if ants also have a mechanism for this.
Yeah, like a super organism developing.
Can detect, bad behavior and eject those ants.
Where are the white...
Slash rip them apart or whatever they do.
Yeah, where are the white blood ants that are essentially, like, their entire role is to...
The bruisers,
yeah, that just look for defective ants. Like, this one is defective and just kills it or eats it or something, like...
Takes it out to pasture.
Yep. And then dies
ant
itself.
Ant pasture.
What's very interesting, I think, as a side note to this is we used to think that humans are one of the only animals that farmed. Like that was, there's a laundry list of things that humans like to think we're special about that just keeps.
Yeah. Like using tools.
Right. That we keep figuring out that other things know how to do and it makes us feel less special. So then we look for the next thing. At one point, farming was one of those things. Ants farm, which is funny to think about.
Only certain ants, but yes.
Fair. But it's weird to think about
and they don't just farm, like, plants.
No.
They have livestock.
Yeah.
Which is wild to think about.
But what's even more wild to think about with that is that it's not even... It's easy to think about that from the human perspective of, yes, there are ants cooperating to make sure there is food. But if you think about them as one superorganism, that would be like our body herding bacteria that it can consume later. But can that bacteria can be used to reproduce and consume things that we... It's like similar to how cattle and other animals like that have certain gut bacteria that can digest certain things that we cannot.
Right. They convert things that we can't eat, grass, into things that we can eat, meat.
Right. But even then, the cow can only eat grass because of other bacteria that can digest that. But instead of eating the byproduct, digesting the same bacteria... that is digesting the thing that you ate. Like, that's just weird to think about.
Yes.
You know? Which, by the way, would be a very interesting strategy to, I think... That's one of the most interesting food replacement strategies I think I've ever thought about is... Instead of thinking, what is the minimum combination of nutrients required that I can put in some kind of soylent form and drink? why not give yourself a gut bacteria? Because we know that there's non-human bacterial cells.
Yes, there are actually more bacterial cells in your gut than there are human cells in your entire body.
Right, but they're smaller, so it works
out. Yeah, they're very small, yes.
But imagine you could take a bacterial culture that you can digest. So there's a delicate balance to get this started where you have to consume them and the thing that's needed for them to eat, but you consume them with something that you cannot digest, but they can very rapidly and reproduce, but then you digest them instead, and they can convert something that is maybe really common that we normally can't digest and convert it to sugars
basically,
that we can.
Yeah, you find the thing that you cannot eat, sprinkle the special salt on it, which is made of bacteria, right. And then now it becomes edible and yes. Nutritious.
I mean, that kind of, I guess, maybe be how alcohol do, but not for nutrition's sake.
Right.
Sprinkle the special dust on it, and it all of a sudden makes me feel funny.
We do have a special dust like this, yeast.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we use it for stuff that's not alcohol also.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. But we don't eat the yeast. Well, we do, but that's not what we're...
Yeah, but we're not getting the nutritional value directly from the yeast, but the processing that they do.
Right. But imagine that we did do it for the yeast. Like, you take a little yeast packet and you sprinkle it on, like, grass clippings, and then it just quickly becomes something else that you can eat. Or it doesn't even have to be quick, necessarily. I guess it had to be timed with your digestive system. But that's the only reason I'm
right.
Going...
The way I'm imagining it is, yeah, you have a plate of grass clippings, you sprinkle the special dust on it, and now it becomes an edible salad.
Yeah.
You eat it. It still tastes like grass, but... And you actually get some nutritional value from it instead of not.
Right. But the nutritional value is not gained just by putting the dust on. It happens actually inside of you as you're digesting the bacteria.
Right.
They're reproducing
it does an intermediate step. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to make it nutritional to you.
Right. And what's weird is that is kind of how ants farm.
Yes.
If you think about them as a superorganism, they herd some other thing within them that they feed things that they don't eat.
I think it's aphids.
Yeah. That's
a type of aphid.
Super interesting.
Yes.
That's eusociality, the human commentary side. But that's like the one that everyone talks about when it comes to other types of animal relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how we would feel if we looked at the other types of sociality.
Okay.
So I've pulled up a list, the Wikipedia article on sociality.
Yes.
To see what other kinds of sociality exist. So there's a header section for things called pre-sociality. So the example given here is solitary animals such as the jaguar do not associate except for courtship and mating. If an animal taxon shows a degree of sociality beyond courtship and mating, but lacks any of the characteristics of eusociality, it is said to be presocial. Although presocial species are much more common than eusocial species have the disproportionately large populations. So that's a big umbrella. So you have presociality, which is essentially everything that's not eusocial, which is kind of funny. But underneath that, you have what's called subsociality. So subsociality is common in the animal kingdom. In subsocial taxa, parents care for their young for some length of time. Even if the period of care is very short, the animal is still described as subsocial. If adult animals associate with other adults, they are not called subsocial, but are ranked in some other classification according to their social behavior. If occasionally associating or nesting with other adults is a taxon's most social behavior, then members of those populations are said to be solitary but social. Definitions and further subclasses of varieties of subsociality. That's weird. I don't understand this. I'm just going to skip it because it like references a book in a whole sentence, which is unnecessary.
Okay, cool.
Whoever edited this did a bad job of copying. Subsociality is widely distributed amongst the winged insects and has evolved independently many times. Insect groups that contain at least some subsocial species are shown in this tree. Blah, blah, blah. So essentially, maybe it would be a bit easier to go the other way because instead of jumping from up and down. So let's go from eusociality backwards. So you have parasociality, which is the one right beneath eusociality. sociobiologists, talk about a made up job.
Wow.
Place communal, quasi-social, and semi-social animals into a meta-class, the parasocial. The two commonalities of parasocial taxa are the exhibition of parental investment and socialization in a single cooperative dwelling. Communal, quasi-social, and semi-social groups differ in a few ways. In a communal group, adults cohabitate in a single nest site, but they each care for their own young. Quasi-social animals cohabitate, but they also share the responsibilities of brood care. This has been observed in some Hymenoptera and spider taxa, as well as in some other invertebrates. And then a semi-social population has the features of communal and quasi-social populations, but they also have a biological caste system which delegates labor according to whether or not an individual is able to reproduce. So that's like the group right below. So it has some of the characteristics that eusocial creatures have, but not all. And apparently, I guess the defining thing here is like, do you have offspring? Do you care for them? You know, and do you do it kind of in groups or not? You know, mostly, or you know, whether you're caring for other offspring that aren't yours, or you're just isolated groups caring for their own offspring just together. So I don't know what the like, in my mind, I'm having a hard time thinking of like what creatures would do this, I guess. So that one's not that great. This is turning out to be not as good an idea as I thought it was. But like, let's take the spiders for example. So like, you open the door to your crawl space and you just see a bunch of spiders chilling in a corner. There's no spider queen or anything.
Right.
But they all, it is advantageous for them to build their nests together because they can funnel more food in that way. And even if something technically lands in someone else's nest, you fight about it maybe if you're both hungry. But ultimately, there's probably enough food to go around. So it's not a big a deal. What's funny, I guess, looking at this is I would have expected humans to fall into here. But there's the last section that's only one sentence that just says, some made up career people claimed in 2005 that human exhibit sufficiently sociality to be counted as a eusocial species. We're special too. And that this enabled them to enjoy spectacular ecological success and dominance over ecological competitors. So this is just like a concept of human eusociality because, like, we aren't, I don't think, at least by the definitions given. We don't brood care like that. We don't defer our offspring raising to someone with the same genetics as us. And I'm starting to feel like...
Yeah, and there's not like... Okay, there are some people who reproduce and some people who don't, but that's not... that's not like a function.
It's a feature.
It's... I'm doing my part.
I'm going to remind your wife of that someday or whomever. It's like, hi, are you his part? Sorry, well, please continue.
But yeah, it's not because like, okay, some of us are specialized to certain roles and have lost our ability to do that.
Right. Yeah, I think that's the key thing. We do not have a caste system except for those that we've enforced on ourselves that are in no way genetic. At least I don't think so.
Right.
You'd have to be a real eugenicist to think of it that way, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's another place that U prefix comes in, ain't it? Yeah. The good genetics. Eugenic. Okay. I do think we dive into that topic because
because we have the time.
We have the time, and I don't want to sit here and go over the difference between how like bottlenose dolphins and spiders are in their social groups because it's honestly boring.
I don't know what you're talking about. That's what I spend my weekends thinking about.
Okay. Well, I spent my weekends thinking about the Roman Empire, so apparently. So yeah, let's talk about it. So there was a book that I was going to want us to read and do an episode on that I'm going to shoehorn conveniently into this episode, so you're welcome. A Brave New World. Are you familiar with this book?
I'm familiar with this book.
Have you read the book?
No.
Are you familiar with the concepts in the book?
Kind of, distantly. Okay.
So, I have read this book. This is one of those 1984-ish novels about some dystopia. And in this particular dystopia, they worship Henry Ford, my Ford and savior, as they'll say. Not even joking. I think
that's
it's
great.
Yeah. Or Ford help you, or my Ford. Anyway, that's funny. But
it is very funny.
In this book, there's some things we won't get into. It's kind of a disturbing novel to read in some ways. Fun fact, it was one of the banned books for a long time.
I did know that.
It was censored a lot. For weird reasons, by the way.
Well, I know that there are some kind of disturbing images.
Which I don't
think... By today's standards.
Well, yeah.
And especially for the standards of the time.
Right. So, let's go into it. So, in this world, humans have been largely separated into two groups. Feral humans, which, by the way, would be us, i.e. humans that have a sense of individuality and still do nasty, gross, disgusting, backwards things like procreate. Because in the proper society, which is based in, you know, Great Britain of all places.
Yes.
Where all the best dystopias come from.
Where 1984 is based also? Yeah.
All the best dystopias come out of Britain thinking they're better than everybody else. Coincidence.
I think it's the weather.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that...
British weather.
So, in this society, everybody is vat-born, essentially. And not only are you vat-born, but they will randomly... So, they take in genetics from the populace. It's harvested. We'll leave it at that. Willingly, usually, by the participants as a part of their civic duty. And it is just thrown in a vat and boom... fetuses. And they will get separated into different production lines, essentially. So there will be some fetuses that are, and they're like classed. So there's like S, A, B, C, D, E, F classed. And they are in a caste system in this way. But they take it one step. They do the thing that would actually, I think, make humans eusocial, which is if you are a D or if you're like a C or a D class, and again, this is a book about human societies. The science on this is by no means, I think, good, but they will do things like put your embryonic sac in like hot environments so that you like hot environments and dark environments like mine. You like it. And they will make people that are just happy, like genuinely happy, because they are just satisfied and familiar with a certain state of being. So, for example, like I gave before, they will just grow humans that they know are going to be doing hard labor in the colonies in Africa where it's hot and everything. And so it's not immoral because they are happy to do it that way. Mm-hmm. And they were born to do it, right? And I think that's ultimately the question of the book is, it's trying to show...
Is slavery or caste systems immoral if the participants actually enjoy it?
Right. Well, and then there's the meta subtext, I think, of is eugenics wrong because we are enforcing our will onto others, even if we're doing it before, even if we're doing it in such a way that we would have, they would choose it themselves. Mm-hmm. Right. And that ultimately is like the moral question around eugenics, because on paper, genes are not people. Genetic material is not people. But if you could make a person that was just really happy, you know, working the fields, and they just could not imagine a better life, and you don't have to make them do it, much in the same way that there are ants that their entire role in life is to be nothing but harvesters. They will leave the hive, right, following the group, and they will pick things up and bring them back.
Yeah, they don't complain about doing that.
That's just what they do, right?
Right. That just is life to them. Yeah.
Right. So, that's one of the many things in that book that are interesting, I'll say. But we don't do that. Well, obviously, we don't breed via vat system, first of all. But we also don't at least I don't think anyway, I'm pretty confident that we don't. It's difficult because I know that different people just like different things, right? That's just a fact. Some people want to, for example, live on a farm and they're fine with doing farm work. They're happy to do it. Other people love living in the city in a shoebox because it's fun. And right now we are all free to do whatever we want, right?
More or less.
More or less. If you wanted to go live the big city life, go ahead.
No one's stopping you from doing that. Yeah.
Right. There may be other barriers to doing it, like, you know,
the cost of moving
and that. But if we eliminated all those costs, people would usually move to wherever they wanted to and do what they needed to. But I feel like we also don't, like, but why do we want to do those things? Why do you want to farm? Why do some people want to go live in the city? Why do some people want to be artists? Why do some people want to be teachers? And I think we look at everything through an economic model, right? Like, that's the way we typically model our societies as well. There's money in it, and you need to survive. And so that's just how it is. But there's this whole other axis of tolerance and subjective value. And don't get me wrong, the economic model takes into account subjective value,
mm-hmm.
right? But it doesn't, I think, consider whether or not that subjective value is something you can manipulate. So far, we were only looking at the shared value as something that's manipulatable or that is manipulated by the rest of the economy,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I would love to be a teacher, not for that salary, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I am in a place where I value money more than doing that job. So yes. I will do a different job that I would not prefer as much because I would prefer to have the money for an exchange. Right. But that's just my personal opinion. What if I really, really wanted to be a teacher? Because there are people I believe that are like that they really want to have more money, but they want to be a teacher more.
Right. So they do it.
Right. But what if there was a central committee that wanted to come up with, and this is the other thing about 1984, but also in A Brave New World, is there is a central committee that like determines what the society needs. So in much like most communist societies, it accounts for a central planning bureau, of which, of course, that's where the A-class humans work because they're the smartest humans and we need them to go plan everything else.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can see how this story ends, but, you know, they figure out what all we need and they schedule out decades in advance the workforce to make sure that we have enough workers that are going to the exact right jobs so that not only are we maximizing the output that we need for the society to actually sustain itself, but we're also manufacturing happiness in such a way that people will just choose to do it. And so it's not authoritarian, right? Like, no guns required to make them do this. They will just do it,
right,
and be happy to do so. And I feel like that would make us eusocial, honestly. Like,
yeah.
At that point, we were fulfilling all the requirements, and that's what it would be like to be that, but also still have some semblance of individuality, right? That sounds like hell to me, though.
Right.
But me in that society wouldn't think so.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about that. That's kind of a tangent. That's kind of where that's kind of the weird headspace you have to get in when you think about AI and changing AI's priorities, that for any intelligence, artificial or otherwise, there are, like, you have your own, okay, there are two types of goals. There are terminal goals and instrumental goals. The terminal goals are the things that you intrinsically want to do, right? Satisfy your hunger, etc. Whatever your base instincts are, that those are your terminal goals. And so one instrumental goal, an instrumental goals are like intermediate goals that are conducive to your terminal goals. So and for humans, an instrumental, or actually any intelligence really, an instrumental goal is money. Anything that functions like money is an instrumental goal, because with more money, you can better achieve your terminal goals.
I was going to say mo problem. Sorry, let's continue.
Stop.
I can't.
So another instrumental goal is not wanting your terminal goals to be changed. Avoiding changing your terminal goals. Because if your current terminal goals change to some other, then your original terminal goals will not be fulfilled, probably, because you're no longer seeking them. So it is in the interest of you achieving your terminal goals to not let those goals get changed. And that's why we have such a hard time imagining ourselves in the position of somebody like that who is doing something that we think is hellish, but they actually enjoy. Because the only way we can conceptualize it is thinking about our own terminal goals being changed into that new configuration.
Right.
But it's horrific to us because we know that we're not going to be achieving the things that we do want to achieve right now.
Right. And so
like the classic example given is like, okay, you know, would you murder your own child? Well, no. Most people would say no. Okay, but what if I like modified your brain so that you would be happy to do that? Right, and that's terrifying to think about.
Sure.
So yeah, same idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's interesting to think is I don't actually think that ants live a hellish existence for ants. And it's weird because it's how they got there.
Mm-hmm.
They evolved to be that way. I don't know that humans could evolve to be that way. I think we're too far down a rabbit hole to be like that.
Yeah, it would take too much of a jump out of the valley, so to speak, that we're in.
Mm-hmm. Or way too much time that I can't even conceive of where we'd be at that point. Right.
Right, yeah. Or, yeah, just so much time that who knows what would happen. Yeah,
we would not probably even be recognizable as humans at that point.
Right. For as long as it would take for us to become eusocial, yeah, we would not be recognizable anymore.
Right. But what I think makes the Brave New World example so terrifying is that these are still people in the book. Like, they are recognizable to us, but they have also artificially become this way. People chose to make.
Right, it's like what would it look like if enough people decided we're going to do this? Yeah.
Right, and don't get me wrong, it still happened over generations, right? It's not like the carpetbaggers came in and kicked over the stool of government and said, okay, we're doing this now, and then one generation later, everyone's huffing happy pills, and which that's another thing about, I think every like dystopia is there's like a pill or something that everyone has to take to keep their emotions numbed. Like, that's another big component that I think is weird that they have to, like, put in. And maybe they put that in there for the reader because the reader has to have, like, the reader, it does not seem realistic to the reader that this is even possible without some kind of drug. But it is. Like, that's the thing. No drug would actually be required if this was done the way
it's at least conceptually possible, yeah.
Right, yeah. If the science was good enough and they engineered this the right way, no drug would be required to suppress your emotions about it at any level.
You would just have the right emotions about it, yeah.
Right. I mean, okay, quick tangent. The only way that makes sense, and this is a thing that I don't think we're going to talk about today, but we may dip our toes in a bit, or we may have referenced it before, but it's the innovation or ethical innovations, like thinking about ethics as a tech tree. Have you unlocked, you know, your social ethics yet as a race, humans? But people kind of talk about it that way sometimes. And so if that is true, then it does stand that if you create a caste system like this where castes B and below, or maybe C and below, don't, like, they're so infatuated with their work that they can't even be, because they're not being conditioned to ever think about other things, like they're literally just not capable of it. They're actually incredibly unethical. Like, they will kill to keep working in the mines. But the fact that no one wants to stop them from doing it means that no one ever dies, right?
Mm-hmm.
But being above, needing to be the ones helming an entire society, you can't have people that are capable of doing that without having people who are also capable of certain levels of ethics. And so I think the underlying assumption there is that ethics are tied to intelligence to some degree. And the more intelligent you need someone to be, the higher of a capacity for ethics they may have. And ethical conclusions know that that's wrong because they're looking at these other people in a caste system and knowing that there's it's a morally wrong thing to do to perpetuate this, so they have to numb that. But that doesn't, they don't go into that in the book. And I don't know that they've thought about it that way. The authors did, and at least I'm not kept up with like what Aldous Huxley thought about things. But like, you know, that would at least make some sense to me as a form of justification. Now, granted, that's lying on some pretty huge assumptions about ethics, that there is this objective realm of ethics where there is good and bad ethics, and it isn't just about, you know, the unanimous nature of the exception, the accepting those ethics, right? A good example, slavery, is one we talked about before. For the pretty much forever, and even in other animals, slavery is just a thing that happens. It's just a very, it's a great thing if you're not the slave, you know,
right? Like,
and it's a huge economical boon. And it wasn't until very, very recently that we just happened to reach a critical mass where enough people thought it was bad that now we all kind of see it that way. What's weird to think is that there was a time when if you thought that slavery was bad, you were weird. You were looked at like the way the PETA people look at animals.
Exactly. Yep.
And that's weird to think about. And that makes me wonder, like, are the PETA people, and I guarantee you there are people who are vegans that are like, yes, I am actually ethically superior to you. Okay. But then again, that's the same attitude the guy.
It's literally the same.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, like, that's the weird that's thing
like,
to think
one,
about.
One of the most common predictions when I hear, like, drag smart person into a room and say, what are your predictions for the future? Or like, and one of the places where that always goes is, what are future societies going to judge us for that we're doing today? And the most common one that I hear is eating meat.
I'll be dead by then. right.
From heart disease, from eating meat.
I'll die a delicious death.
Bacon is a good way to go.
It is a good way to go. Hear me out. Also, I'm an obligate omnivore, so I don't know. But it is hard to wrap my head around sometimes from a moral standpoint. Like, would a human use sociality be morally wrong? Obviously, I think so right now.
Right.
Of course I do. That's
because it's at odds with your terminal goals.
Right. So, but trying to step back from that, it's, you know, it's the same thing when people talk about eugenics. Like, that's a touchy subject for a lot of people because
I think, yeah, eugenics is one of those where it's like, it's sort of like utilitarianism where you can get on board in the abstract if you don't think about the practical consequences. Like, because if you just ask in the abstract, right, wouldn't it be better if we were all, you know, stronger, smarter, whatever, pick whatever human virtue there is, right? Nicer, right. Whatever. Wouldn't it be better if we were all more this way? Yes. I think everyone agrees that it's better. It would be better if we were all more that way. But then when you say, okay, and the way we're going to do that is to sterilize everyone who's not that way, then it's like, whoa.
That escalated quickly.
Hold on a minute. Yeah.
Right. Well, but that also brings up the modern eugenics question of what if we could just, we don't have to sterilize you, but we can tweak a bit your offspring instead. So you're not sterilized. Like, what was the problem with eugenics? Was it the sterilizing or was it the eugenics, right? Because I think we all agree that the sterilizing is pretty bad. Well, I say that. There is a shockingly growing number of people that think sterilizing is a good idea for stupid reasons, i.e. the world not big enough.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Okay. Again.
Different topic.
Different topic. Not for this episode. But, yeah. Well, what actually is the problem? Because, like you said, it, on the surface of it, pretty decent idea. Is it the devil in the details, or is it just the concept itself? And it's hard to talk about, I think, sometimes, especially depending on your company, because you don't want to be that guy who's
okay, let's think about it. Well, okay.
We got time.
We do have a little bit of time, and I don't know if I want to like dedicate an entire episode in the future to eugenics. So
let's
just do it now. Okay. Let's take a step back. Okay, we're not doing sterilization. Let's say okay, if it were possible to okay, people right now are willing to do things to improve their own personal health, right? Mm-hmm. you know, eating differently, taking dietary supplements, things mm-hmm. like that. Okay, what if we invented something that was essentially the equivalent of a dietary supplement, but it made your children better in a certain way, healthier, right?
Yeah.
Would people do that? Probably. Like, why not? Why wouldn't you want your children to be healthier or whatever? All these virtuous things that we think of. Yeah.
Or start with things that we all agree are, we even call them defects. Allergies.
Right.
What if we could get rid of that allergy? Like, oh, right. your child...
Take this pill before getting pregnant and your child will not be allergic to anything. Yeah.
Right. Or get pregnant, come into the clinic and we'll take a look at your child in the womb and be like, oh, yikes. Well, we can fix that when there's a countable number of cells that we can actually just fix.
Right.
You know, and we don't even have to fix them all. We can fix enough of them. Your child's going to be a little allergic, but mostly not. But their children will be 100% not allergic.
Right, yeah. We're actually altering the genes, right? Yeah.
Right. So I think most people look at that and go, yeah, yeah.
Allergies seems like a good, like, yeah, it's just medicine in advance. Yeah.
What about other things like Down syndrome?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. But I know
Down
people...
Down syndrome, mental illness, it yeah.
Yeah, it goes on and on. And eventually, I think your tolerance for what is... And I think this may be like the...
Yeah, that's where it always ends up. It's like, okay, the place where it always goes that ends up horrifying people is like, okay, you know, yeah, you're planning on having a child. So you walk into the doctor's office and select from a menu what child you want. Like, basically.
Right.
Because we have that level of control at that point.
Right. Well, it's that... And or, like, because we could also regulate this. Well, we're going to footnote here, I think, the fact that regulation will just not apply to certain people mm-hmm. because it already doesn't. If you can afford it, you can get what you want anyway, which, by the way, they could also just do this anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think where it ultimately gets to is where, at what point is it not even your genetics anymore? Because at that
exactly, yeah. It, well, any deviation...
isn't
is not your genetics by definition, right?
Yeah, but there's a point where
there isn't there but also no child is your genetics,
right?
You're sharing at least half with somebody else because that's how it works,
right? And even then we do a little shuffling, right?
Yeah, there's still some scrambling. Yeah, so it's just how yeah it all is just a ratio, right? How many genes do you have in common with your child?
Yeah,
but the more you change, the less that ratio is, to the point where, yeah, now it's just somebody else's child. And why are you even having a child yourself at all?
Well, yeah. And at that point, I think we would also kind of become eusocial. But now it's just human genes. It doesn't even have to be our specific genes. But so it's actually further along, I think, than where the ants would be, where it's like, oh, no, we're just well, maybe it's human. Like, why stop there is, I guess, maybe where we end up when that starts to get like, we lose our humanity. I think that's often like the meme that it gets to is we're not even human anymore. But yeah, it's well that and the thing I was gonna say earlier, your tolerance for what's considered a defection, right? Good example. Now, you dear listener at home will not be able to see what I'm about to do. Mental illness.
Right. I put finger quotes.
Finger quotes mental illness. That's a new term.
Right.
Like really new, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things that I look at when I see air quote mental illness that I feel like if I were to talk to a grandparent about it would just be, oh no, that's not an illness, that's just their personality. What's the difference?
Right.
And when you really
who are you to decide what an illness is?
Right. And so
it's just behavior you don't think is normal.
And I'll even pull the definition, right? As long as they haven't changed it in the latest DSM. So, mental illness is a general term for a group of illnesses that may impact on a person's thoughts, perceptions, feelings, or behaviors. So, essentially, non-direct physical illness.
But what does that mean?
Yeah, because we normally, just like any other illness, we don't... If you get sick...
It means you don't think or act like, quote-unquote, normal people.
Right.
That's all it means.
Or, in some modern definitions, the way you think you should.
Right.
But if you're mentally ill, how do you know that what you think you should be like is right? Do you see what I mean? Like,
I think I should be able to pick up an instrument, a musical instrument, and be able to play it perfectly on the first try. I must be mentally ill.
Right. So, this is just an example of how our societal understanding of what is bad enough to be at, this is how things go from being just the way it is to a defect. Illness is in the middle, right? Now, that being said, some things are more obvious and I think commonly shared, you know, the genetic deformities that cause people to manifest like crab hands. Yeah, I think most of us can understand that, yeah, that actually isn't normal because we can just look around and see how many people have crab hands, even though they are actually the more advanced because everything evolves into crabs eventually. It's a fun thought to think about. You know, but...
Reject modernity.
Reject modernity, embrace crab.
Advance to crab.
Advance to crab. Sorry. But yeah, I you know, when you start going down that rabbit hole, you do eventually get to the point where it's like, oh no, your child has blue eyes. It's defective. Like, that's a recessive trait that has been statistically proven to be 0.2% correlated with 0.2% worse eyesight and more eye damage over time or something stupid. Yeah, like
you don't
that.
Want that.
Yeah, you don't want that. Yeah. And then I think we eventually get to the point where if you take this to its ultimate conclusion, is there like a perfect human genetically? Maybe not right now.
Yeah, for what definition of perfect though?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, but and again, at this point, we're looking at something very similar to evolution, but more somewhat artificial, where you just keep raising the bar, you keep lowering the
bar.
You
know, that could actually be a great filter, actually, I just thought. Okay, for those who don't know the concept of a great filter, that is the a proposed explanation for why we have no contact with alien life, that there are one or more great filters in place by which societies of intelligent beings destroy themselves before they get to the advanced spacefaring stage. So a great filter that I just thought of, okay, societies of highly intelligent species learn how to genetically engineer themselves and end up creating a monoculture and are wiped out by a disease.
That is something very simple, like the common cold or whatever.
Right, but yeah, but when everyone has the same genes and everyone is susceptible to it, and they're all just wiped out.
Or they get to the point where everything becomes the same, that they face a problem, much like the cold, that they just can't. Like, there's no, not only, like, I think if you start seeing a society go that way, not only do you see, like, a genetic monoculture appear, but I also think you would see a societal monoculture appear where they would come across a problem, like a black swan event, something that you couldn't foresee, mm-hmm. that in hindsight should have been very obvious, but they're just incapable of addressing the problem successfully and then just, you know.
Right.
The lack of adaptability ultimately is what kills you. Either way, either your genetic adaptability, there's just not enough genetic diversity to survive the event, or I do think there's a weak link between our genetics and our ability and our individuality when it comes to how we think about things, because your genetics inform your brain shape initially and like the initial condition. I do think if you were like, it would be a really cool experiment to try to perform, but example, I don't think it's a mistake that most ant colonies take the same shapes, mm-hmm. for example, because that's what you get when everyone's just running on a state machine is, well, yeah, this is, or if you were to put ants in very similar arrangements, they would all take the same shape. And don't get me wrong, I know some of these things are also informed by like, well, this is just the most efficient shape. Like beehives make hexagons because they're the bestagons. Like they're just mathematically some of the best shapes to build something out of. Okay. As far as a trade-off for what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if there was a better shape, like if you change an environment, right? Like you put bees in some kind of like weaker gravity or whatever, where they could get away with something that's easier to build. And then you just change them and put them in like a different planet with higher gravity. You know, none of them came up with the idea of circles, nests, mm-hmm. and as opposed to hexagonal nests. And so they would just die off. Right. Yeah, that's a really good, great filter that I think would be worth thinking about is, we achieved genetic monoculture because we just kept raising the floor on what we considered to be bad until...
And built what we thought was the perfect species. And it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the more of us the same, the more we kind of see it the same way.
Right, there's a feedback loop. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you achieve monoculture, and then you're... There may be like small deviations from there where it's like that with the change in times, but it's not fast. It's not fast enough, because we don't reproduce fast enough to change our genetics to get out of that situation that we've worked our way into over time. Usually you have the diversity to deal with it. Like, good example, like the Black Plague, right?
Mm-hmm.
If humans had a monoculture when that happened, I actually think it'd be very plausible that we would have gone extinct over that. We happen to, I think, survive because some people just happen to be able to survive it.
Yeah. It was either 1/3 or 2/3. I can't remember the exact proportions. Were naturally resilient enough to survive the Black Death.
Right. And then they all had, like, the Black Death didn't just go away.
Right. It's still floating around.
Yeah, but
those who survived passed on their resistance to their offspring.
Right. Yeah, that's actually very interesting. I'm glad this episode went this way now.
Yes.
I'm happy.
We're way off track from the original topic, but that's okay.
Yeah. I don't think we can go any deeper into this without just having a full-blown episode on eugenics, which I don't even think we need anymore, really.
No.
But, yeah, I'm good with it. I actually kind of want to stop here.
Okay.
Philosophers.
If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.